Sports Talk 750.
Hi, I'm looking for Ray Finkel and a clean pair of shorts.
There was a time in this country when sports were revered. But people today, their values were all out of whack.
Artest looking, gets it to Bryant. Bryant dribbling, has to put it up with the buzzer. Banks it in! Ha-ha! And the Lakers win the game!
But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier!
Put that coffee down.
Coffee's for closers only.
John Stockton sends the Utah Jazz to the NBA Finals!
And I'm just ferocious. I want your heart. I want to eat his children. Praise be to Allah.
Welcome to another edition of Drive Time Sports, KOAL 107.3 FM and 7.50 AM. I'm your host, Jordan Buscarini. We have another best of edition of Drive Time Sports coming your way. Again, we do this every holiday season. Now I'm going to start replaying some of the top interviews that we had throughout 2017 in general. We had one with Peter Vesey, well-known NBA basketball writer. He broke some news in the offseason about potential tampering charges being filed against Magic Johnson. You remember this? It involved the Lakers and the Pacers. Now, the Pacers ended up dealing Paul George to the Oklahoma City Thunder, but Peter Vesey joined us on the show to talk about that because he was the one that broke the news. Also, we caught up with Paul Beston. He's the author of a highly successful American heavyweight boxing novel, which came out this past summer. Terrific book. And he really talked about all different phases of the American heavyweights, dating all the way back to Jack Johnson, up to George Foreman, into Evander Holyfield. Terrific interview there as well. That's what's coming up on this best of edition of Drive Time Sports here on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7.50 AM.
K-O-A-L. Your home for news, talk, sports in Eastern Utah. 750.
Pinnacle Peak Pharmacy, located adjacent to the Castle View Urgent Care Center, is your new neighborhood pharmacy. Pinnacle Peak Pharmacy accepts all insurance providers and can help you transfer your existing prescriptions over. It's as simple as stopping in and providing them with the necessary information, or you can call them at 637-3667. They also offer the only pharmacy drive-up window in Carbon County. Pinnacle Peak Pharmacy, your neighborhood pharmacy.
There was a day when you could gather your employees around a table for a morning staff meeting, pull out a box of donuts, and everyone got excited. Well, sorry, boss, it just isn't working anymore. We've discovered Big Mo's breakfast menu with a choice of several homemade breads for toast, eggs cooked up just how I like them, and the pancakes. Mmm, so delicious. Dare to change things up to get your staff's attention and have your next morning meeting at Big Mo's. Friendly service, delicious food, and great prices. Find them on 700 East in Price.
Tis the season for shopping, and sales seem to be popping up everywhere. Well, Desert View Federal Credit Union has got a sale for you. How about a car loan for 2.99% APR? That's right, now you can save on interest too by getting your auto loan at Desert View Federal Credit Union. Go ahead, get that new car for Christmas. This holiday loan special won't be around for long, so be sure to get into a branch today.
Membership and eligibility apply. Loans on approved credit. Member NCUA.
At Castleview Physical Therapy, they know your health is very important to you. That is why they take pride in offering you the highest quality of rehabilitation. Castleview is the only clinic in the area to be able to offer aquatic therapy. Their warm water pool is inviting and effective in providing a safe method to heal injuries. They are happy to offer this service that has been proven to be one of the best rehab environments to make exercise safer, more relaxing, and less painful. Come in and see how Castleview's aquatic therapy can help make your road to recovery a pleasant one. Call Castleview Physical Therapy today at 636-4841.
You were listening to the best of Drive Time Sports on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7.50 AM.
You're listening to Drive Time Sports on KOAL AM 750, the play-by-play home of the USU Eastern Eagles.
We're back on Drive Time Sports, KOAL 107.3 FM, 7.50 AM. You know, the talk is always that the NBA is a year-round sport, and there's some news that broke over the weekend that definitely holds true to that particular saying. Joining us right now over the telephone, we have a very special guest, Peter Vesey, writing for Patriot. And we're going to talk about that and more, including the news of the possible tampering charges filed against the Los Angeles Lakers. First off, Peter, it is a pleasure to talk with you today. I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
No problem. That's all I got. Time.
Yeah. We'll talk about Patreon here in just a moment, but I want to start by the news that you broke over the weekend about the possibility of impermissible contact between the Lakers and All-Star forward Paul George. I mean, I got to be honest with you. I'm actually shocked that it took this long for this particular story to break. I think this has been something that a lot of people have wondered for quite some time.
Now, you use that word impermissible. I think what Adrian Woj, whatever his name is, used that in his story, I think about 20 hours after it broke on my site, and then basically took credit for the story because he used that word. who did he think the contact was between George and who? The trainer? Boy, I mean, yeah, it was for the magic. Yeah, we get it. Anyway, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right that everybody was saying there was something going on. People were clamoring for tampering almost immediately when George was traded for basically nothing, but you know, for less than his market value, that's for sure. You know, I said, yeah, they got two potential starters. But they didn't get an all-star. They didn't get an Olympian. They didn't get a guy who averaged, you know, 27 a game last year and, you know, shot 39% or so from three and, you know, and all that stuff. So, you know, to have to trade him like that because the agent and the player had said that they were going to, you know, he was going to be a Laker the following year, led people to believe that, well, in order for that to happen, they must have had some contact because, you know, a player isn't going to say that without knowing what he's going to get when he gets there. You know, most of these guys, they demand, you know, like Gordon Hayward, he wanted a max, you know, but you didn't find that out until, you know, the end. But here I would say that a year ahead of time, George has to know that the max is waiting for him. And then for the Lakers to just stand around and do nothing for the summer, knowing that they were going to get him the year after, you know, that shows me, you know, just common sense that there was collusion between the Lakers and George.
You mentioned the fact that Indiana does not, you know, they get two starters in return, but they don't get a superstar in return. And I've always kind of been of the mindset that when you trade an all-star like Paul George, especially at this particular time in his career, you rarely get fair value for that guy in return. But to me, you said you didn't want to say they gave him away for basically nothing. But in my eyes, look, they gave him away for basically nothing. Let's be honest. I mean, OKC got him for next to nothing, and it came out of nowhere.
Well, again, you know, it's amazing that the Pacers would take, how do you pronounce his name, Oladipo, whatever his name is.
Victor Oladipo, correct,
yeah. He just signed a huge contract with Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are you getting, you know, a guy who's really been struggling to put the ball in the hoop consistently, you're getting a contract, which, my goodness. You know, I like him. I do like him, you know, when he was drafted by Orlando, I remember a couple GMs telling me that they would have taken him, you know, yeah, they loved him. They thought he might have been the pick of the litter. And but he has definitely struggled, more so once he went to Oklahoma City than with Orlando. But again, you know, you say you don't get fair value back. You know, most of the time you're not trading superstars. It's when they're free agents that they leave at this point, you know, in time. In sports, you know, unrestricted agents, a lot of named guys up and leave, and you know, and teams get nothing. So, you know, I would say in the past, you know, superstars. You know, I'm trying to think of a superstar. You know, when Earl Monroe was traded, I guess none of the Knicks really didn't get. I mean, Baltimore didn't really get much. Oscar Robinson traded to Milwaukee, Cincinnati, you really didn't get that much. Maybe you're right. Will Chamberlain was traded twice, and Philly didn't get that much. Jeez, I think you're right. I can't come up with some superstars that moved around for another superstar.
It just seems like it rarely happens. Peter, when you release this...
You're going to have me on again, though, because I'm going to do some research.
Okay. Hey, that's fair deal. Absolutely.
Okay.
When you release this story... Now, you're writing for yourself now. And there was an excerpt in this article that stated, you didn't have to have contact with the Pacers. You didn't have to have contact with the Lakers to release this particular article. How nice is it to have that kind of journalistic freedom and where you are at this point in time in your career, knowing that you've been one of the most elite NBA writers over the last 40, 45 years?
Thank you. I always had that freedom. I always had. I mean, nobody ever asked me where I got my, say, how do you know that? Tell us your source. No, you're the one I'm going to tell who my source is. But in this case, I really didn't handle it too much differently than I normally would have. I just wanted to put that on the bottom of my column to let people know, what I did. But, in truth, you don't really know what I did. So I might have lied.
That's right.
Right. So it's all irrelevant. I always had the freedom to, if my editors thought that I had a story, the only thing they wanted to know, a big story, the only thing they wanted to know was, most of the time, where it came from. And I would tell them, that's part of the deal. I have an editor actually now, and he's my partner on this, and he was my editor at the Japan Times, and his name is Jack Gallagher, and he used to be a PR guy in the NBA for the Clippers, and he was with the Warriors, and he's been the Japan Times sports editor for a long, long time, maybe 20-something years, and I wrote for them when I wrote for the Post. He carried my column for 12 years or so. So I told him where I got it. I told him who confirmed it. And I felt that that's the way it should be, and that's always the way it has been. When I broke the story with guns in the locker room with the Wizards, I had to tell my editor, man, I was worried about that one myself. I asked for help on that because that was so big a story that they put people, reporters in the front of the paper on it with me. But I had to tell him, where I got it, and the same, with Sprewell and T.J. Carlissimo, the Strangler. I broke that story, same thing. So, but I've always had the freedom to go and find stories on my own, and then when it gets down to crunch time, I got to let the editor know. So we don't want to get sued. I'll give you something further. So I'm writing a book, and my memoir, and I have a chapter that's called The Undesirables. And, a lot of it revolves around ex-jazz players, actually. So when I met with a publisher, and they did make me an offer, but I didn't take it. But they said, I said to them, look, I'm going to give you these chapters. I did like six chapters, and I want you to read The Undesirables more than anyone. I said, if you can take anything out of that chapter that you want, I'm not going to argue with you because it's your ass, not mine. But if anything's left in, anything that's left in, I want to be indemnified because I'm not going to, I'm not going to be sued and have to answer for it. And they didn't get back to me on that. That's the way it's going to be. I mean, there's no way that I'm going to write that kind of chapter without being protected from lawsuit.
Again, we're being joined right now by Peter Vesey as we talk about the latest story regarding the Lakers, Magic Johnson, and Paul George. Peter, I got a question for you. How much of the league today is agent-driven, and how often do things like this take place? I have a hard time believing that this is the first instance over the free agent frenzy that we have had over the last, 6, 7, 8 years, that this is the first time that there has been tampering involving a free agent in a team. Am I wrong by thinking that?
Did you read my column, or are you not subscribing?
I'm not subscribing as of yet.
See now, I shouldn't even answer that question because you're not even a patron. You didn't even pay $5 a month for my columns. $5 a month. And you wouldn't have to answer that question because that's the lead of my column.
I didn't know about it, to be honest with you.
So I'm not going to answer it.
I didn't know about it until this weekend, to be honest with you. I do now.
I mean, it's been around 5 weeks. I've been on, I've got 35,000 followers. I mean, it's been out there, believe me. But I'm saying that I'm not going to answer it. You're going to have to look it up, and that'll answer your question. You can read it. When you get it, you can read what I wrote.
Fair enough.
You're correct in your assumption, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take it one. I'll give you one thing on it. I believe I don't know the exact year when unrestricted free agency began. You know, when there was no compensation. There was a time when, like a Gail Goodrich went to New Orleans and as an unrestricted free agent, but the league compensated the Lakers with draft picks, and one of those draft picks became Magic Johnson. So the commissioner did that. Then that ended. And then, so I'm getting to my point. So I don't know exactly what year it ended, but I do recall that the team that signed the first free agent was the Suns signing Tom Chambers. He was a Seattle unrestricted free agent. And Jerry Colangelo, Mr. Righteous, Mr. Hall of Fame and Olympian and all that crap. He signed him 1 minute after midnight. So that answers your question.
Yeah.
Come on, man. So it's been going on since minute one of unrestricted free agency. It's a joke. But unless a guy like Herb Simon complains about, this situation, unless another owner complains to the league about, they were after a free agent, but they didn't get to sign. They didn't even get to meet with him because such and such a team signed him at 12:02. I mean, it's ridiculous. Can't be done.
Sure.
And I would love to see. I would love to see the NBA clamp down on stuff. But as I'm told, and you're reading the article, I'm told you can't. It won't happen until you get owners complaining about other owners. Not complaining, filing grievances, pointing the finger.
Last question before I let you go. There has been a back and forth I've noticed here as of late on your Twitter account. Give me your thoughts on Magic Johnson.
Well, first of all, one situation, Magic Johnson's relationship with me and what happened with the Lakers and tampering, two different animals, People have tried to put it together. Well, I wrote that column on tampering, 20 hours before, he and I got into it on Twitter. But that was we're not tight. I don't see him. I'm out of the league 5 years. But we worked together at NBC for a while. I covered him as a player and a coach, and I broke a couple stories that he was involved in, when they got rid of Westhead. I was the one that first had that they were going to dump Westhead Lakers. And I killed Magic. For his participation in that, I've killed him for some things and pumped him up on other things. As a player, what am I going to say? He was one of the greatest players of all time, so there was never a problem there. I broke the story when he made his comeback. I broke that story. I remember going to the press conference in L.A. and 200 writers are out on the court when he's doing his press conference, and he called me out. He said, "How the hell did you find out about this?" So, for him to say that I was bad on TV, which he did 6 years ago, but then there's nothing between us since. But then somebody put that quote up on Twitter. I didn't put it up on Twitter. A follower, some mope, was looking to put one and one together, trying to make one and one two, but I got angry because not only was it up there, and I blocked it, and then another guy put it, I blocked it, and then there are like 15 people, who think they know anything when they know nothing. And then I got angry and said, I'm answering it again. So I answered it 6 years ago. People say, "Oh, wait, is that the best you could do?" after 6 years? No, actually, I answered them 6 years ago, and now I'm going to answer them again. Basically the same quote. And I said on Twitter that I will answer him again. You guys keep bringing it up, and I'll keep going after him. So take the damn tweet down. Don't bother me with that stupidity, because I was very good on television. And he was angry at me because I was saying how bad he is on television. And I think everybody would drink to that, you know? Let's talk about his talk show. I mean, Mooch spent more time with Trump than Magic had on TV with that talk show. So,
well, as far as Magic's talk,
clear it up.
Well, as far as Magic's talk show goes, I gotta be honest. I grew up a Magic Johnson fanatic, so when I was like 8 or 7 years old, the Magic Hour seemed a lot better to me when I was a kid than it does when I go back and I watch clips of it today. You probably understand that the nostalgia factor of a kid getting to see his favorite basketball player on TV a little bit different than an adult today.
But that's a player,
right?
You know what? I hope you don't have any false gods in front of you. I mean, he's no god. Are you kidding me?
Well, no, but when you're seven... After that,
let's talk about it, you know?
But when you're 7 years old, though, do you really care about what these guys are doing off the court? No, you want to mimic them on the court.
Are you seven? How old are you?
I'm 30. At the time, I was about 7, 8 years old when that happened.
So I'm not talking to you as a seven-year-old. I'm talking to you as a 30-year-old. I mean, who cares what you thought about him as a player? You know, now he's a person. You know, look at him intelligently and judge him by what he does and what he says and, you know, his actions and his deeds, you know? Not too good.
Sure, that's a fair assessment. Peter, before I let you go, I'm running out of time in the segment. I do want you to talk about Patreon here so everyone can follow, make sure that they pay the $5 and get to read your articles. Please explain this to us a little bit.
No, it's just a site that I started up. It's called Patreon. It's patreon.com/PeterVesey. And you pay $5 for all my columns for the month. I think for a month you got 15 columns this time. You know, it's like... You know, people are like, I can't even believe that they don't buy it. You know, the New York Post costs $1.25. They used to buy my columns 3 times a week, I think, and then it was on Sunday, so that's like, what, $2.50 or $2.75? So, I mean, 1 week, you're way ahead of the game here. And so, you know, if you want inside information and, you know, you want stories about the past and present, it's the site to go to.
Definitely. And also make sure
I say very immodestly.
Well, and again, you got to make sure you follow Peter on Twitter at PeterVesey1. That's at Peter. Vesey is spelled VECSEY1. Peter, it was a pleasure to talk with you. I definitely appreciate the work. I appreciate the time for coming on today. Thank you very much.
I'm going to look it up now. I'm going to check out any superstars who we got for them, all right?
Do that. And we'll have you back on and we'll go over it.
All right. Take it easy.
Thank you, Peter. Bye-bye. That's Peter Vesey again taking out the time to join us to talk about the latest story that he broke, talking about the possibility of tampering between the Lakers and Paul George. We got a break for just a moment. When we come back, we are going to talk Mayweather-McGregor because it is fight week, thankfully, right? Thankfully. It's fight week. We can get through this week, and we don't have to talk about this spectacle anymore. Larry Pepe of Pro MMA Radio will join us when we return here on this Monday edition of Drive Time Sports.
Mom guilt. We all feel it. Our after-school hours are packed with games, practices, lessons, homework. Between work, grocery shopping, laundry, cleaning the house, how do you do it all and still get a delicious meal on the table every night? Moms, it's time to let it go. KFC has dinner covered. Pick up an 8-piece meal deal tonight. KFC's Extra Crispy $20 fill-up has 8 pieces of crunchy extra crispy chicken, a large coleslaw, 4 biscuits, and 2 large mashed potatoes and gravy. Enough for the whole family. Feed the family and make it to all your events, too. With KFC, it's always a win-win.
Hello, this is Dr. Blake Hillstead from Castle Valley Orthodontics. We are a state-of-the-art orthodontic office specializing in braces and Invisalign for children, teenagers, and adults. We provide complimentary consultations to help you achieve the best smile possible. We accept most insurance plans in Carbon and Emory counties and also accept all Medicaid insurance plans. In addition, we offer flexible in-house financing at 0% interest to make orthodontic treatment fit within any budget. Call for a free consultation with me, Dr. Blake Hillstead, at 435 435- 205-637-2222.
With winter just around the corner, golfing is one sport that just doesn't come to mind. But at TK's Pro Shop, winter is the perfect time to stock up on golfing accessories for Christmas. Just because you can't golf doesn't mean you can't be ready to. Stop into TK's Pro Shop at the Carbon Country Club.
Hi, this is Joe Peterson, the Chancellor of USU Eastern. I'm here to brag about an amazing student we have representing USU Eastern. Chandler Vincent is a welding student here at USU Eastern. He recently flew to Huntsville, Alabama to compete in the U.S. Open Welding Trials. After 4 days of nonstop welding, Chandler was named the USA World Skills Welding Champion. With this title, Chandler won $40,000 in tools and scholarships from the American Welding Society. Congratulations, Chandler. For more stories about the incredible students that we have here at USU Eastern, see our website, usueastern.edu.
Feeling stressed out lately? It might be because of your slow internet connection. According to recent studies, delays in loading web pages and videos increase our heart rate and produce a level of stress equivalent to watching a horror film. Let Emory Telcom help reduce your stress level. With eFiber from Emory Telcom, you'll get the highest internet speeds available. Internet speeds up, stress levels down. Fast downloads and TV like no other. Lower your stress level today and call Emory Telcom 613-9605.
You were listening to the best of Drive Time Sports on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to tonight's main event.
Don't call it a comeback. I've been here for years. I'm rocking my pants. What's up with the beer?
We're back on Drive Time Sports. KOAL 107.3 FM, 7:50 AM. Really excited about our next guest. Anytime I have the opportunity to talk boxing here on the show, you know I jump all over that. But today we have an opportunity to talk old school boxing and dig into the history of some of the most well-known heavyweights to ever grace the sport. Joining us over the phone, we have Paul Betson, who is the author of the new book, The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. It's in stores right now. So excited to have Paul on to talk a bit about this book and to dive in to some of the history of the heavyweights that are mentioned throughout. Paul, a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking out the time to join us.
Hi, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
Definitely, definitely. So we do talk a lot of boxing, obviously, here on Drive Time Sports, but your particular book is centered around when heavyweights ruled the world of boxing. I mean, obviously, we just talked about, a super middleweight contest between Canelo Alvarez and Triple G. We've talked about the welterweight division a lot with guys such as Pacquiao and Mayweather, as they have ruled the boxing world. We don't have that right now in the world of heavyweights. We have a couple of guys that have kind of pushed the division, but your book centers around when heavyweight boxing was it. It was the main attraction.
Yes, and especially from the American perspective, and that's really the key to the book there, is that the heavyweight division was always the flagship of boxing in the United States. In other countries, it doesn't necessarily always have to be. You know, in Latin America, they have so many great fighters of, you know, at the lower weights. The heavyweight division is not as important there. But in the United States, traditionally, while Americans, when boxing was at its peak, Americans liked a lot of different weights, but they really set stock by the heavyweight division. And for most of the period that my book covers, which is over a century, almost every heavyweight champion was an American, with just a few exceptions. And so it was really the flagship of the sport of boxing. And these guys were household names, as the saying goes.
And before we dive into the book, Paul, I want you to go ahead and give us a background on your boxing history and what actually persuaded you to write a book about the heavyweights that we'll talk about here in just a moment.
Sure. Well, this is an old passion of mine, going back to going back to boyhood. I was growing up in the mid-late 70s and early 80s, and that was a time in which boxing was in a better place, at least in terms of its public appeal. It was the late days of Muhammad Ali's career, so I caught the end of that, and Larry Holmes came in, and there were also all these great lower-weight fighters, from Sugar Ray Leonard and Marvin Hagler to Roberto Duran, Alexis Arguello, and the thing about it was they were all on TV. They were on regular TV, very different from today, where, you know, just like the fight you mentioned, Canelo fight was on pay-per-view, and most of the fights are on pay-per-view. Back then, while the biggest fights were, closed-circuit television, a lot of very good fights, championship fights, were just on regular television on Saturday afternoon. And that just drew in a lot of, a generation of kids my age to boxing. And it just drew me in. I mean, I liked all the regular major sports, but the individuality of boxing, it was always just tremendously appealing to me. And I found myself in the library bringing books home, histories of boxing, and reading about people like Jack Dempsey from the 20s, and just fascinated. His whole life was kind of like an adventure tale, you know, traveling on freight trains and working in coal mines and fighting in saloons. And it was just very, very vivid, and it really captured me and took a hold on me and didn't let go.
Again, we're being joined right now by Paul Beston. He's the author of the book, The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. And again, it is now available as of September 16th. This book is available. Paul, let's start by talking about some of the heavyweights that you really take a deep look at. Jack Johnson, Jack Dempsey, Joe Louis, Rocky Marciano, Muhammad Ali, and of course, Mike Tyson. These are polarizing names with the sport of boxing, not even just within the heavyweight division, but with boxing in general. Out of the names that I listed, any of those stand out to you as the most intriguing individuals that you were able to research and kind of delve into?
Well, those guys are all pretty interesting. It's you know, Muhammad Ali really is a special case because, you know, when I was doing this book, I was making lists for myself of kind of, you know, there's a vast boxing library, a vast boxing bibliography, a lot of chronicling, and biographies of most of the major guys, and in most cases, several different good biographies of these guys. But when I say several, I mean three or four. When you get to Ali, you're talking about dozens and really probably hundreds and maybe a few thousand books overall written about him. I didn't even, obviously can't attempt to even cover that many, but I did find myself making a list of really a comprehensive list of the important books about Ali that I really couldn't afford not to read. And it was, you know, it was several dozen. And that was just very daunting, very different than the other guys. Not that there isn't a lot written about them, but as I said, there are a handful of really authoritative books on a Jack Johnson or a Dempsey or Joe Louis, and you can get to those. But Ali is a very daunting task to get your arms around all of him. And there's just so much to cover, and that was the challenge in writing about him. Jack Johnson is another one. He's I think, really probably the most complex of all of these figures. He came around at a time in the early 20th century when the racial climate was just terrible in the United States. I mean, there were lynchings going on. The racism was right in the popular press. I mean, you can read the old newspaper stories, the way he's written about, the language he used, would make your hair stand up. So he was operating in an environment that was just incredibly adverse for a black athlete. And yet he was this very individualistic and bold and defiant man who was really apparently to all sights fearless, unafraid of provoking white anger and resentment. And yet deep down it's really hard to understand sometimes what he was really thinking or motivated by. He wasn't a traditional, you know, he kind of been elevated. Ken Burns made a documentary about him about 10 years ago, and it's kind of elevating him into kind of a hero of racial equality and that kind of thing, and it just doesn't really seem like that really was what was motivating him. I think he was just such an individualist. He just couldn't be bothered with silly ideas and attitudes. He was a person who saw beyond race and wanted to live his life the way he wanted to live it, and that's admirable in its own right, but it's not quite the picture you sometimes get. So he was really interesting to read about, and those are two of them anyway, but really there's not a dull character in the book. This is one of the reasons I wrote it.
We could sit here and talk about the accomplishments of Joe Louis, who is one individual in the sport of boxing that I've always somewhat gravitated to, but the fact remains his accomplishments and his mark on the sport of boxing go way beyond the ring, and this is a part in the book that I have yet to get to, Paul, but I'm definitely excited to get into the Joe Louis section of things here in the book once again on The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. Joe Louis's mark on American history in general cannot be overlooked, and so I'm sure he was just a fascinating character as well.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, Louis, I always admired Louis, but working on this book, it just deepened my admiration for him and my affection for him, really. He'd always been a giant figure, and you know, I never had anything bad to say or think about him, but delving in, I just came out with a renewed appreciation for what he faced. You know, a lot of the same kinds of things Johnson faced with the racism, the kind of right in the newspaper stories, a lot of the same stuff, and yet the way he handled himself was just remarkable. with just remarkable calm and dignity and steadfastness, and he was able to win over so many people, white fans and white Americans who finally got the memo that blacks are Americans too, and there's no reason to root against someone in the ring just because their skin color is different. I mean, Joe Louis persuaded untold numbers of people to think differently about those things, and I do say in the book that in my view he is the most important American he's the most important athlete in American history. I really believe that. If you consider he won the heavyweight championship in 1937, which is 10 years before Jackie Robinson started playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers and integrated the major leagues, and we all know about Jackie Robinson, he's justly celebrated, but Jackie Robinson said on that day that he took the field that if it wasn't for Joe Louis, you know, this day may never have come. And I think Joe Louis's contribution, a really just hugely positive contribution to race relations and social progress in the United States is overlooked.
In your opinion, when we talk about Joe Louis and the racial relations here in this country, how important was the two fights with Max Schmeling in that regard, two racial relations here in the country? Did that play a factor at all, at least in what you've been able to gather?
Yes. Yes, it did. A very big factor because Schmeling, he was being embraced in Germany by Hitler and Goebbels and the rest of them in the Third Reich. And, that's a whole side subject there, which we don't have to get into, but the whole thing with Schmeling and how wholeheartedly was he welcoming and embracing the Nazis' celebration of him. A lot of debate about that goes on to today. Schmeling refused to join the Nazi Party, and he had other defiant acts that seem to suggest that he did not share these views, but he was in a very unique situation, a very difficult situation in many respects. So he was, rightly or wrongly, he was being celebrated by the Germans as an example of the master race, and he defeated Joe Louis in their first fight in 1936, which gave them more grist for the mill to show that the Aryan race was superior. And of course, he'd beaten a black fighter, and they saw blacks as inferior. So he was just became a completely politically loaded fighter at that point, willingly or unwillingly. And when they went into the rematch, Louis suddenly realized that millions and millions of Americans were rooting for him. They wanted to see the American prevail over Max Schmeling. Millions of Jews, for obvious reasons, wanted to see Louis win. But what really became kind of one of history's surprises is that millions of whites started to root for him as well against this opponent of white European background. And that's a major transitional moment, and it was ultimately the national identity about being an American. That's what got through to people, and Joe Louis helped do that. So he knocked out Schmeling in 2 minutes of the first round, so it's the greatest victory of his career. And that was kind of a crucial turning point in getting people to see Louis differently. And what then went further than that a couple years later is when World War II broke out and Louis enlisted in the Army and served in the armed forces and with great distinction. He wasn't in combat, but he traveled around, boxed exhibitions, and traveled from base to base all around the world, and famously said, "We'll win this war because we're on God's side." By the time the war was over, by the time Joe Louis's career was over, millions of white Americans looked at sports a little differently than they had before he came along.
Paul, we have plenty more to talk about. I do have to break for a quick commercial pause. Do you have time to hang with us for one more segment?
Sure do.
Perfect. We have more coming up with Paul Betson, author of the new book, The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring, back after this.
Castleview Hospital would like to thank the 2017 Castleview Board of Trustees for all their hard work and dedication in making the community healthier. Thank you to Lamar Guyman, Scott Justison, MD, Glenn Etzel, MD, Eric Lyman, MD, John Pressett, MD, Bryce Briner, Errol Holt, CEO Mark Holyoke, Mike Jensen, and Colleen Lovelace. Your hospital and the community you serve appreciate all that you do.
Sutherland's has the solution for all your last-minute gifts. We have great gifts at great prices for DIYers and contractors alike. Save over 50% on winter work coats. Right now, only $16.99. Or save $100 on a 10-inch DeWalt job site table saw with a rolling foldable stand. Visit our Dollar Center today. We have over 100 great tools that work perfectly for stocking stuffers for only $1. No matter your budget, Sutherland's has the perfect gift at a great price. Sutherland's, helping you build it better.
Hi, this is Joe Peterson, the Chancellor of USU Eastern. I'm here to brag about an amazing student we have representing USU Eastern. Chandler Vincent is a welding student here at USU Eastern. He recently flew to Huntsville, Alabama to compete in the U.S. Open Welding Trials. After 4 days of nonstop welding, Chandler was named the USA WorldSkills Welding Champion. With this title, Chandler won $40,000 in tools and scholarships from the American Welding Society. Congratulations, Chandler. For more stories about the incredible students that we have here at USU Eastern, see our website, usueastern.edu.
Sports Byline, weeknights from 8 to 11 on News Talk, 107.3 FM and 750 AM KOAL.
Tis the season for shopping, and sales seem to be popping up everywhere. Well, Desert View Federal Credit Union has got a sale for you. How about a car loan for 2.99% APR? That's right, now you can save on interest too by getting your auto loan at Desert View Federal Credit Union. Go ahead, get that new car for Christmas. This holiday loan special won't be around for long, so be sure to get into a branch today.
Membership and eligibility apply. Loans on approved credit. Member NCUA.
You are listening to the best of Drive Time Sports on KOAL 107.3 FM and 750 AM.
In 5, 4, 3, 2.
I'm Joe Wade Formicola, and you're listening to Drive Time Sports with Jordan Buscarini.
Zero name, no gimmicks.
On 750 AM, KOAL.
So I came to the grave. Zero name, no gimmicks. That's why I ain't got no.
We're back on Drive Time Sports, KOAL 107.3 FM, 750 AM. Joined by a special guest right now over the phone, Paul Betson, author of the book, The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. Paul, we left that last segment by talking about Joe Louis, and there's a couple of other individual fighters I would love to talk about, but you can't talk about Joe Louis without mentioning Rocky Marciano, who goes down, well, before Floyd Mayweather, of getting to 50-0. He was 49-0 as an American heavyweight. We're talking about one of the most decorated boxers in our country. Again, at that point in time where the heavyweight division was held in such high esteem, this guy finished 49-0. Talk about Rocky Marciano and the connections to Joe Louis.
Well, Rocky Marciano came along after Joe Louis, of course, and he, as a young man, listened to Louis's fights on the radio, as a whole generation of Americans did. And Rocky was a son of Italian immigrants, and again, it's a sign of the kind of racial and social progress of the people starting to get more liberal attitudes about this, more accepting attitudes about this, that he would be rooting for Louis himself when he would listen on the radio and wasn't thinking about all this racial stuff, you know. So that was a positive thing. He had great admiration for Louis, and when Marciano began his pro career, after a couple years in, he was starting to climb the ranks of the heavyweight division. By now, Louis had retired. He had retired as champion, but then because of his financial problems, came back into the ring, and who does he wind up facing in 1951 but this young rising contender, Rocky Marciano. So they meet in Madison Square Garden. Louis is 37, Marciano is 28, it's a tough fight, pretty good fight for three or four rounds, but Marciano is just too strong and overpowers Louis and knocks him out in the eighth round in a particularly brutal fashion. Louis is against the ropes, his arms are down, and Marciano puts over the final right hand, and Louis falls half between the ropes onto the apron of the ring. His head is bobbing up against the ringside photographers, and it's the final end for Joe Louis, the sad ending of his career, as many great champions will lose that final fight. And Marciano, that was a crucial victory for him to advance himself, but he felt very badly about it. And according to some accounts in his biographies, he cried in his dressing room after and sent Louis a condolence note. So he was really knocking out his idol there. And then from there, Marciano goes on a year later to win the heavyweight title and held it for three and a half years. And as you said, he wound up retiring at 49-0. Unbeaten, he's the only heavyweight champion never to lose a fight. So that's a special mark, and it obviously accounts for one of the reasons Floyd Mayweather wanted to, you know, get that into his targets and surmount it. Some listeners might remember that back in the 80s, Larry Holmes came close to equaling it as well. Larry Holmes was a great heavyweight champion, often forgotten, dominated in the first half of the 1980s. He was 48-0. And had one more to go to tie Marciano, and he was beaten in that fight by Michael Spinks. So the Marciano record has a funny way of coming back from time to time into boxing, because it's one of those things like the 56-game hitting streak of Joe DiMaggio. You know, it just kind of sticks in the mind, and it does come up from time to time because fighters come along who want to see if they can equal it.
Again, we're being joined right now by Paul Beston. He is the author of the new book, The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. Paul, let's skip ahead. Let's go all the way to the Mike Tyson era. Now, you know, we've already talked about the likes of Jack Johnson and Joe Louis and Rocky Marciano. We briefly talked about Muhammad Ali. Boxing was such a different game by the time Mike Tyson had captivated a new audience. I mean, I believe you'd have to go back to 1971. Joe Frazier was the first fighter to earn $1 million, if I remember correctly. The first heavyweight fighter to win $1 million in a fight in his first fight with Muhammad Ali. That was the norm by the time Mike Tyson had kind of captivated a brand new audience. And the boxing game had changed drastically by this point.
Yeah, the boxing game had changed a lot, and yeah, the big money purses had really come in, especially after Ali. I mean, Ali, his promotional abilities really drove up the purses, and by the time he was finished, you know, when Larry Holmes was fighting his biggest fight in the early 80s, made $10 million for that fight, and by the time Tyson was coming along in the late 80s and he had his biggest fights, he was making $20 million. Of course, these numbers now seem ridiculously small when you read that Floyd Mayweather would make $200 or $300 million for a fight. It's just really hard to wrap your mind around, but yeah, Tyson came along when the heavyweights had been quiet for a while. Again, it seems unjust to say that with regard to Larry Holmes, because he was such an excellent champion, but he did not have that special ingredient, which is sometimes hard to identify, that captures public imagination. He had the bad luck of following Ali and then coming before Tyson. He's kind of sandwiched between these two incredibly charismatic figures. So the attention had kind of gotten off the heavyweights a little bit. For boxing's sake, it was very fortunate because they had Sugar Ray Leonard and Duran and Marvin Hagler and Thomas Hearns and all those guys going at it in the 80s. So there were a lot of big fights. Boxing in the 80s was doing well for public interest. And just as those guys were starting to wind down, Mike Tyson comes along, and he's the savior for the heavyweight division, and he returns the heavyweights in an instant, right back to the top of people's focus. I mean, once he's in the game, forget it. People want to see Tyson, and he was just an electrifying performer. I mean, you didn't want to leave the room. I mean, you sure didn't want to make sure that you missed the first round, because that might be the only one. So that's just one of those appeals that Jack Dempsey had it before, back in the 20s. Same kind of appeal, you know, this magnetic quality that people need to see him fight because of the aggressiveness. And so he was just a giant. I mean, from the late 80s to the early 90s, and then, of course, he's just kind of one of those examples of too much too soon. And he was only 23 years old when he lost his title to Buster Douglas in February 1990 in Tokyo, which is pretty justifiably called the greatest upset in boxing history.
As far as Mike Tyson's story goes, and again, this is one of the chapters that I have definitely read, it's so interesting to me to see how this guy's life evolved in such a short period of time, and then it was gone in such a short period of time, as far as the marketability for Mike Tyson, which I don't think ever fully left, but it definitely took major blows along the way. I mean, you mentioned the loss to Buster Douglas. Once Mike Tyson comes back and we finally get the fight with Evander Holyfield that we thought we were going to get in 1991, not only was he beaten handily by Evander Holyfield in the first going, the second rematch, of course, is the Bite fight, which you also mentioned. It just seems to me, Paul, that when you look at Mike Tyson's career, it could have been so much more. It moved too quickly at the beginning, and it ended too fast at the end.
That's absolutely right. I think I don't have the sentence in front of me, but I said something like, you know, a lot of the chapters were torn out of the book. You know, that's kind of the sense that I think a lot of fans were left with was Tyson. That wasn't there more? I thought there was a whole bunch. It's kind of like being forced to leave a movie a third of the way in. You know, it's like, well, wait a minute. Where are we going here? And his career had that feeling to it from the moment he lost to Buster Douglas, really. Now, in retrospect, when you look back, that was really kind of the end. I mean, he did come back in the mid-90s after he served his rape conviction, but it was really... it was really a pale imitation of what he had been. And as you said, once he met up with a fighter of his caliber, Evander Holyfield, he couldn't beat him. So I think there is a great sense of incompleteness to Tyson's career. On the other hand, you do look at the two or three years in which he was dominant in the late 80s, and there aren't that many heavyweights who've even done that. I mean, he did go through the division pretty well. And quickly and decisively. So, you know, he deserves his place, but it is always a place that will have some ambiguity to it, because you have that sense that there could have been so much more.
Not a huge selection on the heavyweights once we get past the talk of the Holyfield and the Tyson, the two-fight saga that we had there. But in between and around that same era, there were some other very interesting heavyweight storylines. I know you do mention George Foreman for just a bit. I mean, he stepped back into the ring against Evander Holyfield. A lot of people mocked George Foreman at that particular time in his career. His quest was to win the heavyweight championship. He actually succeeded in that plan by knocking out Michael Moore. I know you mentioned Riddick Bowe. To me, and again, that was the era that I grew up into the heavyweight division. It was a very fun time for the world of boxing.
Yes, it was. I mean, the 90s, in fact, the last chapter is when I covered the 90s, and I said that, it was really really just like a merry-go-round. I mean, it was every time you thought that you had it figured out or what was going to happen next, the script would get overturned. You know, Riddick Bowe arrives in 1992, just after Tyson has gone to prison, and he beats Holyfield. And people say, okay, now he's going to be the guy because he's so big, he's so strong, he's got great boxing skills. Holyfield, people always thought, was maybe a little too small. And Bowe has beaten him, and now he's going to take over. Well, the next year, Holyfield, in a rematch, takes the title back. Okay? Well, maybe Holyfield's the guy. 4 or 5 months later, he loses to Michael Moore. Wow, okay, who's this Michael Moore guy? He's going to fight George Foreman. Well, that's not a serious fight. George Foreman knocks him out, you know? So it kind of goes back and forth like that, and there was a lot of drama to it. And then, of course, not long after that, Tyson is getting out of prison, so now he's getting back in the mix, and you've got Tyson and Holyfield and Bowe and George Foreman. And so, yeah, it was an exciting time in the heavyweight ranks, and really about as busy and bustling as any other time except for the 70s when you had Ali and Frazier and Foreman and guys like Ken Norton and Ron Lyle and all kinds of tough, interesting contenders. But the 90s was great. Unfortunately, it was also the end.
Right, right. And this is kind of I want a what-if question. I got to give you a what-if question here, Paul, because you did mention briefly in this chapter that the Tyson and the Foreman fight never came to fruition. We thought that we were going to get that. There were rumors of it taking place outside of the country, but it never came to fruition. I know we never got to see Tyson and Bowe. So give me the what-if fight of the 90s. If Paul Beston was a promoter and you could go back in a time and you could create one super fight from the 90s, what would it be?
One super fight from the 90s. Well, I would have loved to have seen Holyfield and Tyson fight the time when they were supposed to fight, in 1991, but that got interrupted. Tyson pled an injury in training, but most people think he was really starting to get very distracted by his legal defense for his the rape trial was coming up, and then he was going to be convicted for that, and so that was the end of that. That fight didn't happen until 5 years later. So I think that would be one of them. Even then, though, in 1991, Tyson was a little diminished from what he had been, so you almost have to go back farther. And then if you go back farther, Holyfield wouldn't have been at his peak, so you know how those things go. Also, Tyson and Riddick Bowe, it's a shame that they never fought. Both from Brownsville, Brooklyn. That would have been quite a battle. And Riddick Bowe never fought Lennox Lewis, the British guy who also gets in here in the 90s. So it's a very competitive time. A lot of fights, actually. For all the activity that there was, there are a few fights that didn't happen.
Right. Fascinating stuff. Paul Beston, again, he is the author of the book The Boxing Kings, When the American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. Paul, it was a pleasure to get you on the air and talk a little bit about this book. Before I let you go, I'm going to let you sell this to the listeners on why they should go pick up The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring.
Sure. Well, it's first, the story of these guys is a story in itself. They're interesting characters. They're interesting people. They're not just athletes. Their stories say something about the country, and I think that's interesting in and of itself. And the other reason is to be reminded or to learn for the first time of the place that this sport and this title once had in the United States and in the history of sports. If you're a sports fan, this is a big part of the story, and you may not know it.
Paul, it was a pleasure to talk boxing with you over the last two segments here on the show. Thank you so much for taking out the time. And I got the PDF version of the book. I'm going to continue to read it. I've had to skip around to make sure we could touch on certain topics of it, but it's fantastic work, and I can't wait to get to the end of it. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jordan. I appreciate the time.
Terrific conversation right there with Paul Betson. Again, author of the book, The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. It is available right now. I highly recommend you pick it up. We're out of time today on Drive Time Sports. We'll be back to do it again tomorrow. He's Travis Anderson. I'm Jordan Buscarini. Be safe. We are out.
Listen to Drive Time Sports weekdays 4 to 5 on News Talk 107.3 FM at 7:50 a.m. KOAL.